This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Zachary Berger. Dr. Berger is both primary care physician. He's also the author of a book called Health for Everyone. He's at Hopkins in Baltimore, a brilliant physician and leader. Thrilled to talk today about what he's thinking and health for everyone and a lot more. Dr. Berger, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about what drove you to write the book?
Sure. So I'm a primary care doc and bioethicist in Baltimore and have the benefit of treating a lot of people who our systems have not well served or actively harmed over the years. And the strength of our book, Health for Everyone, is that it's an edited book. You know, I do have a couple of essays in the book, but it really brings together a number of co-authors who bring various sorts of expertise, whether it's being clinicians and taking care of patients, educators, researchers, patients themselves, and activists, speaking for the interests of underserved groups and for conditions that get overlooked.
Now, you don't have to answer this, but who's your favorite co-author? Do you have a favorite? Are they all favorites? All like children? They're all favorites.
They're all my favorites. I will say that the strength of this group is that it's a lot of different people with a lot of different sorts of outlook. And we're all, but, you know, interestingly enough, even though we're all different people, we're all focusing on similar ways in which the system have to change, but applying those to the needs of different individuals, which I think is really the circle that you have to square in healthcare, right? Like, we all know there are systemic injustices and inequities, but the person in front of you is different and unique, and you have to treat them uniquely. So the fact that our co-authors really came around to the same issues and address them each in their own individual way is a real strength. The other thing I should say is, you know, there's still a pandemic going on, and some of the co-authors who agreed to it at parts of the project had to drop out. And so the folks that, you know, I'm really happy with the group that we got together and those that were able to participate.
You talk about some conditions that are often overlooked and some communities that are often undertreated or mistreated. Give us a sense of some of the conditions first, and then some of the communities that are underserved or not treated well.
Sure. So, you know, I think while I say overlooked, I think these are things that people know about, but you don't imagine it's things that we could do better. One doesn't imagine sometimes that these are things we can do better on. We all know people with chronic pain, and anyone that's a clinician sees a lot of people with chronic pain. And the idea that these are overlooked conditions seems maybe counterintuitive, because a lot, you know, if you're in primary care, if you're seeing patients, people with chronic pain take up a large majority of the time. But I still think pain as a symptom and as a chronic condition is something that really gets overlooked in a lot of people. I'll give another example, and that is, people with substance use disorder. There's so much stigma attached, so many ideas that are really not worthwhile that we've, you know, levied on people or lobbed at people. And to understand how to treat people with substance use disorder on their terms is really something we haven't managed to do. As far as overlooked groups, you know, a lot of the book are things that are not intellectually new. It's really calling people to pay attention to things that we've known for a long time. So we know about about the fact that our systems, you know, are racist and segregating and have maldistributed resources. You know, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And so to make these points and to say things like, you know, African-American hospitals are closing in rural areas, or that language concordant care is not being delivered, or that migrants, you know, people migrating to the U.S. are not being treated humanely. These are all, I think, if people know about them, obvious points. But many people don't know these facts, and sometimes these facts are more convenient to overlook. So that's part of what we're trying to do here is bring these facts to the fore.
I'll give you a couple phrases, and you'll tell me if these are misguided efforts at substance abuse or not. Okay, bear with me. You don't have to answer if you don't want to, but I think this will be quite easy for you and right in your sweet spot. The first phrase I'll use is one that came out about 30 years ago, and the phrase is for treating substance abuse, treating drug addiction is, quote, just say no. And how well does that work?
It doesn't. I mean, I think, you know, just telling people to abstain, there's a lot of moralizing. I think we both know that goes on in healthcare, right? You just tell the patient to be a better person and all will be well. You know, life doesn't work that way. And although, you know, it's very natural to moralize illness, it's a human tendency. I think oftentimes we moralize at the wrong people. You know, we tend to act morally superior to those that have less power or less resources. And Just Say No doesn't really recognize how addiction works, how dependence works, how access to treatment works.
No, we couldn't agree with you more. Obviously, it was a misstated idea, and ended up probably being one of those kinds of things that probably set, if there's a war on drugs, quote unquote, set it, or a war on addiction or trying to fight addiction, it probably sent it in the wrong direction. It's probably did three strikes, you're out, probably did as well. Probably ended up being a misguided idea to fight crime or fight addiction, but just really a debacle of an idea ended up being the three strikes, you're out concept, I assume.
Yeah, I think the people that authored the substance use treatment chapter in our book would definitely agree with me that the war on drugs is completely a misbegotten effort, and incarceration of people for substance use is just completely wrongheaded. And the fact that we haven't rolled that back is medieval in the worst sense. So I completely agree with that.
And talk about, there's this really interesting given perspectives on gateway drugs. Obviously, it's become very popular to legalize cannabis, and it's done a great deal for some states' own budgets. I mean, state of Illinois, I think we're raising $500 million this year, and it helps. We've got huge budget shortfalls. And then you have these very different perspectives on, can cannabis be a gateway drug or not? And I don't know the right answer. I really don't. You know, I'm not what have you. We've seen addiction in our family. I'm somebody that does touch pot periodically or cannabis. I'm back from a generation that called it pot periodically, so excuse me. But is it a gateway drug or not? Not really. Any thoughts on that or something?
Well, I'm not a substance use expert. I'll leave that to the authors of the chapter. But I can say in general that my approach to substances, and I think the approach of the authors of the chapter, is that everyone uses substances, and it's just by historical contingency that some of them are legal and some of them are illegal, right? What's the most common, most dangerous substance? It's alcohol, right? And so we need to provide spaces for people to consume substances safely. And that's something that the authors of the chapter do bring up. And safe consumption spaces are something that's a live reality and effective in Vancouver. It's been legalized in Philadelphia. I forget where they actually are practically on that. There was a demonstration project recently in Baltimore. So I think if we can, you know, the choice for people is, are they going to use these substances in the bathroom of a McDonald's, right? Or are they going to do it in a place that has the services they need safely? So that's what the choice that people are dealing with.
Thank you very, very much. And when you think about how to improve healthcare for everyone, how much of the new model or the evolution just has to be towards preventive care and population health, just given the lack of the amount of doctors and clinicians and providers we have in our country? How do you sort of switch this, or is that part of the perspective or not?
I think prevention is definitely important. I would say that a lot of the claims made for preventive health are from a austerity/cost-saving direction, that if we just had better preventive health, we would keep people out of the ED, people wouldn't need to go to the doctor as much. So I think people need care. So we need to get people the care they need. We can't cut down services with the idea that we're spending too much money. I do think preventive care means the most basic things that we're denying people, right? So people need food and housing and money and jobs, right? And so all these things are prevention. So we need to, I perfectly agree. We need to get people those things. And many of the co-authors in this book make those points in their various particular realms.
But your point is well taken. It's not a cure-all. It's not a panacea. It's important, but we need a lot of things beyond healthcare to help with that as well. And then it shouldn't be an excuse for shutting off access on the back end.
Yeah, I think people love to make the claim that if we'll just get people more access, people will go to the ED less and we'll spend less money. Well, you know, there was a study in Oregon, I think, that, you know, I think it was Oregon, is that, you know, Medicaid expansion will decrease ED visits. Well, it turned out not to do that. Why is that? Well, people still need to go to the ED. Sometimes people find the emergency room more convenient than their primary care doctor. We need to figure out why that is. But we shouldn't act like providing better access will magically reduce utilization or save us money. That's not the way healthcare works. It's a basic need of human beings, and we need to provide it.
And we can agree with you more. And quite frankly, what we've seen with my elderly parents is more and more, it's almost like a going back to the future is that we find the emergency department ends up being the best place to take them. Doesn't mean it's the cheapest, but you know, often when they have a challenge, they can't get into the primary care, they can't get into the right urgent care, they can't get to this, and it just ends up being the only place where we can get the full evaluation that we need done for my parents who are in their 80s and 90s. It's really become it's very interesting to me. It's really been an evolution of thought as to, oh my goodness, how do we end up back here? We're going to the ER for things that 5 years ago we would have gone and sat down at length with the primary care physician who could do a full workup and so forth. And most just don't have the time or energy today and are so overwhelmed or swamped that they just can't do that.
Yeah. Right.
Dr. Berger, how do we, I mean, I'll ask you a couple questions. And one's too broad, but I'll ask, the first question's easy. Where can people find your book?
So a number of places. I think the place where a lot of people still go to buy the books is Amazon. So I would definitely check it out there. You know, it's if you're not able to go to Amazon or want to avoid it for whatever reason, you can definitely go to bookshop.org. That's an alternative site. You could get it at your library. If your local bookstore doesn't have it, you should order it. You should definitely go to zacharyberger.com. That's ZACKARYBERGER.com. Sign up for our mailing list. We have sample chapters from the book there. And, you know, I encourage people to contact me. A lot of people can't afford the book. A lot of people are really in difficult financial straits. So people should reach out to me. I'm pretty available on social media. And you know, I can figure out a way to get the book to them.
Phenomenal. Again, Zachary Berger, Dr. Zachary Berger. So the next question, you mentioned Amazon, and you mentioned, you know, there's a hint of a thought there that, look, some people don't love Amazon being such a behemoth and having so much control over our world. And you mentioned, you know, if you don't like being on Amazon, you can get it here, get it from Dr. Berger, et cetera, et cetera. Amazon's made the most recent foray into One Medical, buying this huge sort of primary care roll-up type of thing. Any thoughts on that? Is that just more going to help those that are already served in healthcare and not sort of help the underserved communities and so forth? Any thoughts of that or something you don't want to speculate?
No, I'm definitely happy to address that. You know, it's not something my co-authors talk about in the book, but I will definitely say personally that, and this was said by healthcare industry watchers on Twitter, so I'm just going to rephrase things I read, which I happen to agree with, is that Amazon's idea is that by getting into the primary care space, they're going to make money by treating the healthy people and finding other people to take care of the sick people, right? And that's how a lot of our healthcare is working. And that's like the wrong direction. So I don't think anyone is saying that Amazon is going to better serve the underserved, right? Or spend more money on people and or get people the stuff they need. That's not the model they're visiting. They're a profit-making organization, and they're going to try to make money by delivering care to the people that need less money spent. So, you know, that's more power to them if they want to do it that way. I don't think that's the way to go.
But this is a fascinating perspective. And people talk about, you know, all of a sudden in big health systems, there's been a movement towards quote unquote value-based care. And the eye-opening experience for many of those health systems, aside from Kaiser Permanente, was not really trying to do something better or better for the community or anything of the sort. What really the eye-opening experience for many of them was in the pandemic, the Medicare Advantage large groups, the big payers just cleaned up. They cleaned up because they're on the subscription model getting paid, but not having to deliver services. There weren't procedures being done. So all of a sudden, the big Medicare Advantage groups just got rich. They made more money than anybody during the pandemic, as did the big payers. And so what was the aha moment, you know, people could couch in all kinds of different discussions. We need to be more value-based care. We need more preventive. But you're right. I mean, preventive is very healthy. In some countries, you have no choice because there's just not enough doctors and nurses on the back end. So you better be more preventive. And there, even in India, who has built a preventive model, when COVID really hit hard, they just found themselves completely overwhelmed because you can only use so much prevention and you need enough doctors and nurses still. But the health systems grew to love value-based care, in my view, for at the end of the day, the wrong reasons, just because it's a more profitable model for them at this point, or can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that's our capitalist system that these organizations are incentivized to make money, and that's what they go after. You know, it's sort of, when you think about it, it's one of these shocking but not surprising things. And in trying to remake health on the basis of communities actually driving the bus is something that the book is about.
Thank you, Dr. Berger. Again, Zachary Berger, Dr. Zachary Berger, author of the book, Healthcare for Everyone. Great thinker. Thank you for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you.